Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, I sit down with the brilliant and the clear-thinking Dinesh D'Souza. He made the great films Hillary's America, 2016, and of course, Obama's America. He is smart. He understands his issues very, very well, and we dive into all things driving the left, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. So before we get into it, email us, freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. And of course, make sure you are subscribed to The Charlie Kirk Show. Type in Charlie Kirk Show, hit subscribe. We got some big episodes coming up for you guys. Give us those 5-star ratings and leave us a review. All right, everybody, buckle up. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
All right, we're here live on the Charlie Kirk Show with my friend Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh, thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Good to be on the show.
Absolutely. And you're about to debate a socialist in front of a couple thousand students. So tell us a little about that.
Well, I'm excited about it. It's probably atypical for him. He's probably used to swimming in socialist waters where he's the big fish and everybody's applauding. This will be an interesting experience to him arguing before conservative students. Of course, for guys like me, this is normal. You and I live in a world where we're always in the leftist camp. And so we're used to dealing with hostile audiences. I told him to expect something very respectful, and people will listen to him and hear what he has to say, and it should be a lot of fun. Debates, yeah. I think, are really cool. They don't occur that much on campus. I'm glad we're having one here. Yeah,
totally. And you and I do a lot of campus, you know, events and visits, and the closest thing to a debate is you and I visiting for 90 minutes and having leftists tell us how wrong they think we are.
Yeah, the closed-mindedness is what's so startling. Mm-hmm. You know, you have kids who are, you know, they're 19, they're 21, and their assumption is, hey, Dinesh, you know, you're in your 50s, but you don't know anything, you haven't read anything, you have no idea how the world is, but I do. And that, the arrogance of that is, it takes you aback a little bit. Now, in some ways, you have to set it aside in addressing these kids and try to get through to them. But yes, I think there's a sort of dogmatism that academia mm-hmm. is cultivating. It's very unhealthy.
So, Dinesh, there's a debate on the right that is growing, and I'm trying to see it happen ahead of time and have discussions about it, of what is the proper role of government in dealing with some of these societal and economic challenges. And you're even seeing people on the conservative side say we should be trust-busting monopolies such as big tech, and you know we should be banning pornography. I don't know if you've seen that debate.
Yes.
What's your stance on some of these issues where you and I would agree that they're definitely big problems, but there's a growing audience on the center right and the right that think that, well, while we have the majorities, we should use the instruments of government to try to disallow or make these things illegal?
Yeah, so this debate has actually occurred in the mainstream of American conservatism from the beginning. If you go back mm-hmm. to the old National Review, for example, of the 1950s, it was divided into camps. You had the sort of libertarian camp, which was mm-hmm. essentially called, you could call it leave me alone conservatism. The government should do as little as possible in any domain. And the libertarians even skeptical of the Defense Department. Their argument is whatever the government does, it does badly. Then there are the paleoconservatives who are sort of, you could almost call them the nostalgists. They sort of hearkened to an earlier time when things were simpler, morality was more firmly in place. They don't like the moral chaos of modern society. Mm-hmm. Then there were the anti-communists. So you had all these different wings of conservatism and arguing with each other. So conservatism started out as a fractious bunch of very disparate people. Now that it's become a movement and it's, you know, it got power for the first time really under Reagan, it consolidated itself. And I think what we're seeing now is sort of people returning to some of those original questions. Mm-hmm. Like, is it the government's role, for example, to sustain morality? Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question. And conservatives have given different answers to it from the beginning. So my thought about this, I mean, I have individual thoughts about particular topics like what did pornography, for example, or trust busting. I mean, I think even a libertarian would agree that when you have large agglomerations of power that are preventing, that are creating barriers to entry, new people can't get in, then that is a reason for the government to step in and break them up.
And so it's not just those two issues, but of course this has been going back for some time. My fear is that if it's not, and where I stand on it, if we don't have principles when we go towards these sorts of issues, then what would be the limitations on government power? It's just we would be just arguing we can run government better than the other side. Not to discount the observations of these challenges and these issues that actually exist in present society. Are you guys suffering under student loan debt because of the cartel of the colleges? Well, I'll tell you right now, there's this amazing service out there called Credible. Credible.com is an online marketplace that gets you pre-qualified student loan refinancing rates from up to 10 different lenders. They help people get out of student loan debt. If you've got student loan debt, you could benefit from this. Look, they'll refinance your student loans. And what are the benefits of that? Well, you get a lower rate, which means you could save on interest or lower your monthly payment. And with a shorter loan term, you could get debt-free faster. You can consolidate all your student loan bills in one place. You get a serious peace of mind. Credible customers have given awesome reviews about how much better their lives are after they have been refinancing their student loans. On Credible, you can see actual pre-qualified rates from up to 10 different lenders. Whereas with some other marketplaces, you'll get ranges of rates or ballpark estimates. It only takes a couple minutes to check rates. Checking rates doesn't impact your credit. They never sell your data, so you won't receive spam and phone calls from dozens of lenders. Look, Credible is going to get you the best refinanced rate possible. So please visit credible.com/Charlie. That's CREDIBLE.com/Charlie. When you refinance your student loans via Credible, they'll give you a $200 gift card. Fill in a couple pieces of info to check out what rates you're eligible for. Again, that's credible.com/Charlie. Refinance your student loans and start saving. Dinesh, what would you say, for example, in this debate about big tech, what would be government's proper role in Facebook, Google, Twitter, Amazon, where they control such a huge part of the channels of distribution and communication?
So my view on that would be something like this, that big tech right now is trying to have it both ways. They're trying on the one hand to say, we're like the phone company. You know, we're a forum for the exchange of information, and therefore we should be immunized in terms of liability lawsuits from the content of that information. We're not responsible for it any more than AT&T is responsible for what you say when you make a phone call. So they want that immunity. On the other hand, they say, we're publishers. We want to control content. We want to be able to kick Charlie Kirk and Dinesh D'Souza off the platform when we feel like it. I think the government has every right to say, no, you actually can't be both. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be a publisher and someone is libeled on Facebook, they should be able to sue Facebook. So I think we should take away this governmental immunity that is given to organizations that are not like the phone book, but are in fact more like the New York Times and should be held responsible for the content because they themselves say they are.
And so the platform publisher is a very, you know, it's becoming a more popular, you know, point that we can put forward, because there are some people that say completely trust bust, you know, these big tech companies, regulate them, put them like public utilities. I don't think that's the right approach whatsoever. I think it actually goes against our principles.
We wouldn't even want the government running the New York Times. I mean, we don't want the federal government running information exchanges in our society, no. But I think, on the other hand, conservatives would just say something like, these are private companies and therefore we have to leave them alone.
Well,
and
that's a population on conservatism that is pretty vocal. But they're actually decreasing in number. They are.
Right.
More and more conservatives are saying, no, we have to do what is right now. Because, Dinesh, I can make the argument Google's more powerful than the federal government in a lot of different ways.
Well, what it is that if you think about it, democracy is about an educated citizenry who exchange ideas. Google is sort of stepping in the back room and controlling what you see. So when you search for something, they're not giving you a neutral look at what's out there any more than the New York Times is giving you a neutral look at what happened yesterday. No, they're choosing. We're going to cover this. We're not going to cover that. Oh, the Republicans are questioning the witness. Let's take it off CNN. Let's go to something else. we're all now alert to this, so we're not as dumb as we used to be, you might say. And so I think the debate is a very healthy one, and we need to have it resolved in some way.
Sure. So Dinesh, if I had one lie I could deprogram in America's youth, it's the lie that the party switched, that Republicans and Democrats switched. You have done more incredible work on this topic than anyone else. Your book, The Big Lie, is absolutely terrific. Not to mention your original works of, you know, your original movie works are incredible. Both the Barack Obama's America, where you articulated his worldview as being anti-colonialist and anti-imperialist first and foremost, which is spot on. And we've actually talked about in a previous episode of The Charlie Kirk Show. I read what you actually said. This is where they're going. This is where the left is headed. So let's start with the big lie and the big switch. Dinesh, what do you have to say when people say the party switched, Republicans and Democrats switched, and it used to be the Republicans were actually Democrats. So that means they were the good guys and the bad guys were actually Democrats, and now those people are Republicans. What do you have to say to this?
Well, the people who promote and teach the big switch, and as you know, it's taught as, sort of, you may say, gospel in our schools, they build off of two facts. This is the heart of their case. Blacks, who used to be Republicans at one time, became Democrats. And the South, which used to be heavily Democratic at one time, is now largely Republican. So those are the two facts holding up this big switch parable, you might say. Mm-hmm. Now, as soon as you drill into these two facts, you begin to realize that they're both kind of hollow. First of all, blacks did switch to the Democratic Party, but they didn't do it in the 60s. They didn't do it in response to civil rights. Mm-hmm. They switched in the 1930s because of the crumbs that FDR offered in the New Deal. Remember, it was the Depression, so something is better than nothing. And even these paltry programs, which were segregated, by the way, nevertheless, blacks were like, this is something I need to live. I'm going to vote for FDR. So this switch occurred in the 30s, has nothing to do with civil rights. Mm-hmm. Number two, the South began to move into the Republican camp gradually starting in World War II. The switch really occurred, the Southern switch, in the 80s under Reagan. Now think about it. What was Reagan's agenda? Anti-communism, patriotism, free markets, Christianity, family values. So those were the Reaganite sirens that drew the South, the increasingly non-racist South, into the Republican Party. So the fallacy of the big switch is to say, here are all these Democratic racists in the 20s and 30s. And now, look, the South has become Republican. But it's not the same guys. Those guys are already dead. Mm-hmm. There's a whole new generation, the new South, if you will. And initially, the South that began to move Republican was the urban South, the most professional, the least racist South. So the big switch is a kind of a fable that's intended to take all the crimes of the Democratic Party, from slavery, segregation, Jim Crow, lynching, the Ku Klux Klan, all the horrible stuff that they did, mm-hmm. and magically stick it onto us and make them seem like the good guys.
And the other argument is, why is it as the South became significantly less racist, it became more Republican? It should have been opposite. It should have been, as the South became less racist, it should have either stayed Democrat or continued that trend if the parties truly switched.
Yeah, I think looking back, you know, we underestimate the incredible role of World War II in delivering a mortal blow to racism. Prior to World War II, the idea that some races were better than others, more intelligent, more morally superior even, was respectable. You could argue it as a position. But once American soldiers went into the death camps and pulled out those ghostly, emaciated, starving figures, the whole world saw with a kind of shock, this is what racial supremacy leads to. So that delivered a mortal blow to racism. In fact, ironically, the anti-racist campaign didn't begin with Martin Luther King. He was the beneficiary of it. It had already begun in the 50s. Mm-hmm. That's why Martin Luther King was so popular. People were like, this guy's right. And the Southern segregationists went into a kind of silence because their argument had already been discredited.
Yes. So what do you have to say about the Southern strategy? I get that a lot on campus, Dinesh. People say that there was a Southern strategy launched by Richard Nixon and many others to intentionally try, this is what they say, intentionally try to win over Southern racists and turn them into Republicans.
So the best way, I think, to blow that up is to simply say this. Okay, here's Richard Nixon, and I concede that as a private man, Nixon was a bundle of prejudices. And by the way, not just against blacks. He was suspicious of Jews. He didn't like Ivy Leaguers.
He like the Kennedys.
Yeah, he had a kind of, he was a bottle, a Pandora's box of prejudice. But in public, Nixon was a very Machiavellian, calculating guy. So here's the point. If he's making all these appeals to racists, name one. You know, let's go to Nixon's campaigns. Give me some quotes from Nixon that he said on the campaign trail to racists saying, hey, guys, I'm one of you. Hey, guys, let's give it to the blacks. Let's see the evidence of that. The amazing thing is there's not a single example of an appeal mm-hmm. that Nixon made. So how's he signaling to racists? Is he speaking to them in code?
That's what they actually will say.
They say he uses, quote, dog whistles.
Dog whistles, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
But I mean, think of what a dog whistle is. A dog whistle is a sound that is so shrill that a human can't hear it, only a dog. Now think about it. In politics, can you actually make a noise that all the other voters, all the media can't hear, only the racist dogs can hear? It's crazy.
They think Make America Great Again is one of those.
Right. Or I'm going to be tough on crime, or, oh, I'm going to speak up for the average guy. I'm going to try to make his life better. They interpret these generic appeals to the ordinary guy as racism.
With this new year, it's time to get started on improving yourself. No one knows this better than one of my favorite sponsors, Vincero. I see Mr. Producer wearing the watch right now, Vincero Watches. These guys know just how important it is to look and feel your best, and they are here to keep you motivated through 2020 and beyond. If you're looking to upgrade your look, don't waste money on some cheap cookie-cutter watch that doesn't get you noticed. This watch will stop people. I'm telling you, it's a great watch. Finding a watch that's stylish, bold, and built to last can cost a pretty penny. Vincero's Watches is changing that. They believe you deserve to look good no matter what your budget is. You deserve better than settling for something underwhelming. So head over to VinceroWatches.com and check out my favorite picks and take advantage of my special discount when you shop. Remember to use the code Kirk. Vincero understands the frustrations of online shopping. These guys get it, and that's why they make it as easy as possible for you. Vincero offers free shipping, 30-day returns, and guarantees your watch for 2 years. It's stress-free shopping with fair and honest prices. When you put it on, you immediately know you got more than you paid for. It's the best value for your money, guaranteed. This is why Vincero has 20,000 five-star reviews on their site. You can read for yourself. No matter who you are, what your job is, or how old you are, or where you live, there will always be an occasion where you want and need to look your best. Dates, interviews, weddings, nights out, you need a stylish watch. So I'm telling you right now, don't overpay for a watch that looks cheap and disappoints. This is a timepiece you'll use. This is a piece that will last. This is something that will help you look and feel incredible so that you feel prepared to take on the day and accomplish everything you set out to do this year. This deal is really too good to pass up. Get the year started the right way. Go to VinceroWatches.com. Use my discount code Kirk, K-I-R-K, for a discount at the checkout. Do not pay full price on these beautiful timepieces. Use my code Kirk at checkout.
Dinesh, the other thing I really wanted to, you know, talk to you about is the, as you talked about in Obama's America, he was a true Alinskyite in a lot of different ways. And so here's a thing I want to throw out. I think the American left right now, Bernie Sanders, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, they're not following the teachings of Alinsky the way that if they wanted to accomplish their end goals should be, in the sense that Alinsky talked about a true radical would be someone who wears a three-piece suit and pretends to be someone he's not and infiltrates institutions. Bernie Sanders and AOC, they wear their radicalism on their sleeve. And Barack Obama, I think, disguised it a lot better. And in fact, you talked about that, and you talked about the origins of where his ideas actually came from. What are your thoughts on that? What do you think if the left is actually turning their back on these Alinskyite tactics in that sense, where do you think that would end up?
Well, it's very surprising in a way because, of course, Obama was successful. Now, this is hard for us to say and concede because we think Obama was horrible. He was a failure. But he was actually successful in doing what he set out to do. He wanted to weaken American power, and he did.
Yeah.
He wanted to increase the role of the state and
its tentacles
into finance and banking. And he wanted to be able to fire the head of General Motors, and he did. So Obama was successful from that point of view. And how did he do it? in a stealth way. He crept in as, I'm this guy. By the way, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, the same. He was interviewed by Ramos, Jorge Ramos. He goes, I'm not a socialist. Oh, am I going to nationalize industries? Of course not. I'm not going to do any of that. But, and it took him, in fact, in the case of Chavez, 9 years to start the Socialist Party of Venezuela. So the point I'm trying to make here is Obama was essentially a leftist in disguise, at least initially. And you would think that the Democrats would have learned, hey, that works. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. But you, even with Biden, you don't get the feeling they're doing that. And in a way, the left has come out of the closet ideologically. And I don't think it's to their benefit.
Yeah. And the more they expose themselves as radicals early on, it seems that the American people will inevitably turn against that. It sure seems that way.
Look at Elizabeth Warren. She goes, I'm going to get rid of private insurance, and her candidacy takes a nosedive and just starts dropping, mm-hmm. In free fall. And then she has to start backing off and say, well, that's not exactly quite what I meant, and it's too late. It's hard for her to resuscitate her candidacy. So, yes, I think explicit leftism and socialism, not an appealing message on the national level.
Absolutely. So, and Dinesh, you also talked about the origins of Hillary Clinton. You did that movie, you did quite well. And she was an Alinskyite, and she studied Alinsky in Wellesley. And that was one of your best films, I think, was terrific.
Yeah. I mean, think about how odd it is that Obama and Hillary both
were disciples of Alinsky.
Of the same guy.
Yes.
And also learned the gangsterism of Alinsky. In his Playboy interview, talks about how his model was the mafia. He says, I learned in the mafia how you get people to do things that they don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, he essentially cultivated these two ideological thugs, Hillary and Obama, who began to put, and look, all of the stuff going on in America today was started then. There was no, this gangsterization of the Democratic Party, we didn't have it under Carter, mm-hmm. we didn't have it under Truman or JFK. It's Obama and Hillary who got the whole thing going.
We all have an idea of what our dream job looks like. I actually have my dream job at Turning Point USA and hosting the Charlie Kirk Show. But guess what? Someone isn't going to hand that to you. Odds are you'll need at least some level of certification to make that a reality. Now, not everyone needs to go to college, but some careers you might need a bachelor's degree to succeed. And guess what? That's why you'll love Ashford University. They are convenient and flexible. Their online bachelor's and master's degree programs allow you to learn at your own pace. You can study wherever you're the most comfortable learning. You can do one course at a time. Ashford University's 6-week-long courses allow you to take everything one course at a time. Being enrolled in one class at Ashford means you are considered a full-time student. There's no standardized tests required. The SAT, GRE, GMAT, and other standardized test scores are not required for enrolling at Ashford University. Now, Ashford University is fully accredited by the WASC Senior College and University Commission. So get on the road to earning your degree and making your dream job a reality. Enroll now by going to ashford.edu/Kirk. That's ashford.edu/Kirk to start your degree today. ashford.edu/Kirk.
And so, Dinesh, what other projects are you working on that you'd like our audience to know about? Films, movies, speaking tours, books?
So I've just finished a draft of my book. It's called United States of Socialism. And we're doing a movie of that title.
Oh, wow.
Or that's the working title for next summer. So we've been shooting in L.A. and Dallas, and I'm very excited about it. We've got a kind of a fresh take on a very old topic, but an old topic that is with us in a new way. And we think that idea, that's going to be the big issue in the 2020 election, socialism versus free market capitalism, and we want to make the moral case.
So Dinesh, on that note, do you think America will be more or less socialist in 10 years?
Less.
That's optimistic and refreshing.
Yeah, I think so. But of course,
we get all sorts of different answers. I ask that question to everybody.
Yeah. The reason I say less is, but my answer is it's contingent upon us. A lot of our fate doesn't depend on them. We're often waiting for them to behave themselves. And I'm so tired of this Republican rhetoric, where we tell the Democrats basically, stop wasting your time on impeachment. Do what's good for the country. They don't care what's good for the country. They're going to mm-hmm. do what's good for them.
Yes.
They will stop doing bad things to us when it starts hurting them, when it's bad for the Democratic Party and it's bad for them. So we've got to figure out, how do we make it bad for them? But these generic appeals to civility and the greater good and you're hurting the country, you're dividing the country, these people couldn't care less about any of that.
Well, and yeah, they're unbelievably Machiavellian in that sense. I mean, they will rule with an iron fist. They will forego virtue. They will for everything that we think to be decent. And the greatest example of this, outside one isolated individual, no one interrupted these impeachment hearings at all, from protesters at all from people screaming or people scratching on doors. And how many times was Kavanaugh interrupted when they tried to...
Well, they count on us being the party of the nice guys. They count on our decency, our restraint, and our virtue to their benefit. It's not just that they ignore virtue.
So true.
It's the line from Milton, you know, evil be thou my good. And when you see things that are really bad, you notice that they get really motivated. What's the number one issue that gets the left the most excited? What will they fight the hardest for? Abortion. Mm-hmm. That's their sacrament. They care more about abortion than the minimum wage.
Why do you think that is?
Because ultimately for them, taking this totem pole of moral values, right, and inverting it is the key to their cultural strategy. The left has needed a cultural strategy ever since Marx.
Yeah,
Gramsci. Yeah, going back 100 years. So they have to attack the family. They have to attack community. They have to attack morality. And they do that with even greater venom than they attack economics.
And that's where we get the school of deconstructionism. And we get these postmodern garbage ideas. And Dinesh, I'll tell you, when I visit these campuses, I find miserable people when they actually try to assume a cultural Marxist worldview.
Their misery, you're right, they're confused and they're angry and they're miserable, and then they find a perverted way to be happy about that misery. And by that I mean it's the joy of victimhood. It is the idea that I can
Oppression Olympics.
Yeah, I take all my sufferings and I project them onto society and I create a massive drama in which I am the protagonist, but I'm the victimized protagonist and I'm waging a heroic battle for my freedom from all these oppressive forces.
And the person who embodied this more than anything else was Jussie Smollett, because instead of wanting to become a better actor or a better singer, he wanted to become a hero victim. So he staged his own fake hate crime, to say, look, I should be loved because I have been victimized.
Here's my favorite part about that whole thing. The cops come to his apartment later.
He still has the rope on.
He's still wearing the noose, right? He's still got it on. So Here's what, let's just think this through, right? Because if you talk to Jussie, he's probably going to say, well, guys, listen, maybe I did that, but I was trying to call attention to
That's
racism.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I was trying to highlight the omnipresence of racism in our society. But think about this. Blacks in 1890 did not have to stage lynchings to call attention to the presence of lynching, because there were so many lynchings going on, you didn't have to fake a lynching.
That's right.
So if racism was so pervasive in our society, Jussie really wouldn't have to put on that noose himself and still be wearing it when the cops showed up.
That's how you know you live in a great country.
And that's how you know you live in a country where cases of racism are becoming harder to find.
That's right. Well, Dinesh, we can't wait to have you debate socialists both here and all across the country, and you're a great friend of our organization and our show, and good luck.
Thank you very
much. Thanks so much, Dinesh.
Thank you.
What a terrific interview with Dinesh D'Souza. Make sure you guys buy a copy of my upcoming book, MAGA Doctrine, pre-sale. Let's make it New York Times bestseller. If you want to get involved with the fastest growing, most important youth organization in the country, go to tpusa.com. That's tpusa.com. Make sure you guys are subscribed to The Charlie Kirk Show. Hit that subscribe button. Leave us a 5-star rating. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Till next time, this is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show. The Adam Carolla Show is the number one downloaded podcast in the world, and you have got to check it out. Catch up with some of Adam's latest interviews featuring James Carville, Pauly Shore, and Rob Hubel. Adam's bringing you daily rants and musings with a side of comedy. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps so you can get new episodes every week.